David Kaczynski is brother of the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski and is with us this morning for an extended segment to talk about his new book, Every Last Tie. In August 1995, David Kaczynski's wife, Linda, asked him a difficult question. Do you think your brother Ted is the Unabomber? He couldn't be, David thought, but as the couple pored over the Unabomber's 78-page manifesto, David couldn't rule out that possibility. It slowly became clear to them that Ted was likely responsible for mailing the 17 bombs that killed three people and injured many more. Wanting to prevent further violence, David made the agonizing decision to turn his brother in to the FBI. Every Last Tie is the highly personal and powerful memoir of his family, as well as a meditation on the possibilities for reconciliation and maintaining family bonds. David, formerly of Schenectady, served as assistant director at Equinox in Albany, a shelter for runaways and homeless youths. He also served as executive director of New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty and more recently as director of a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Woodstock. It is a great pleasure to welcome him back to the area and to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. It's a thrill to have you on the program.
Wow, it's great to be here.
You were with us many years ago, and Alan did a beautiful interview with you about this this situation, and I know we even honored you as a radio station for being a person of courage. Was it at a point that you knew that you wanted? This seems like a story that you feel like that you almost have to write.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the immediate aftermath of my brother's trial, of course, at that point we were focused on hoping that he would not get the death penalty. And after he was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, I got involved in some other death penalty cases and really had a very, very strong feeling that I wanted to work against the death penalty. And of course, there was the issue of mental illness in my brother's case, so I became somewhat of a public advocate for more available treatment and better understanding of mental illness and support for families that struggle with a mentally ill family member. So in some sense, you know, for 15 years or so, the focus was a bit external. It was kind of like working to try to take this terrible tragedy and turn it around and bring something positive out of it. And then in 2011, our mother passed away, and I retired and went to a Buddhist monastery and started meditating for about an hour a day. And at that point, I think my focus became a little bit more looking backward and looking inward, and hence this book emerged. And I think you're right. I kind of had to write it.
There's a picture on the cover of the book of you and your brother. This is circa 1952. Your brother is older. He has a parakeet on his shoulder. This is a very quintessential 1950s photograph. You were both looking slightly to the right of the camera lens, and but big smiles on your faces. The age difference between the two of you is
seven and a half years.
Yeah. So, at what point did you see? Did you understand that there was something different about Ted?
As I say in the book, I always knew that Ted was special, and special is kind of a tricky word.
Right.
You know, it could mean something very positive, or it could mean something somewhat negative. In Ted's case, I really thought it was something very positive. He was very, very intelligent. He skipped two grades, got a scholarship to Harvard at the age of 16. His IQ was once tested at 165, kind of genius-level IQ. And I really looked up to my brother, and I thought he was very, very amazing person who would contribute a lot to our world. At the same time, he was different than me. He was tended to be not antisocial, but asocial. He didn't have many friends. And I recall asking mom and my father eventually, you know, like, what's wrong with Teddy? How come he doesn't have friends?
I may be reading way too much into this, but I found it interesting that just in the photographs that there's a picture of you, your mother, and Ted, and you and your mother are together, and Ted is off to the right. Mm. And then in another one of the photos, there is here again, it's you and your father, and Ted is off to the left. I mean, there's that separation, right? He wasn't one to sort of be in that picture next to all of you. It seemed like you had to widen the lens a little bit to get him in.
That's an interesting observation. There's another picture in there where he's kind of in the center of the photograph holding a football, and I'm kind of nuzzled against him on the side, and
right.
Mom and Dad are behind looking very happy and very proud.
And you two
proud.
Seem very close.
I think that's true. Definitely there was the developmental difference of an older brother, seven years older. But I think you're right. Mom used to say that when Ted played with other children, it was more like he played alongside them rather than with them. It was kind of like he was a little bit in his own world, did not immediately connect with people on an emotional level the way I did, for instance, or many other children do.
One of the questions I had in reading the book is that, and you touched on it, so I want to bring it up now, and that is that when your mother died and you started to meditate, how much did the grieving of your mother and understanding that loss sort of coincide with the ongoing grieving of dealing with your brother and what the family had been through?
Yes, I think grief is an interesting word, and it's a word that fits. I don't know if I really use it in the book, but mm-mm. Clearly there's a sense of loss. Ted is alive. He doesn't communicate with us. In some sense, the person he was to us, a person with sensitivity and high intelligence, seems to have been lost through the years. So there's a sense of even grief about the family's sense of hope and promise. Our parents were first-generation Polish immigrants. They wanted their children to be well-educated. The future looked very, very bright. And so in this whole family saga, there's a tremendous sense of lost promise. And, of course, the grief over not only what became of Ted, but what he did to other people and how, the question, almost crushing question, how could someone capable of such, of hurting people, innocent people he didn't even know, sending bombs to people he had no reason to resent, how could someone like this emerge from a family that had our values?
I mentioned the conversation that took place in August of 1995 between you and your wife. What do you think it was about your wife of just being that much on the outside of things to look at it in a more global perspective and say, could this possibly be the case?
I think that has something to do with it. When you grow up with someone, you spend your life with someone, you tend to kind of normalize them, you adapt your expectations to them. When you come into the family structure from outside and you see how much adjusting has taken place over the years. That I remember once, this was long before we thought Ted was, the Unabomber. I'd showed some angry letters that Ted had written to me, and Linda looked at these letters and she looked up at me and said, "David, your brother's sick, you know that, don't you?" And now, I took psychology courses in college. I should have been able to see this. And I said, "No, you have to understand, he's a genius. This is the way he thinks." And Linda's looking at this passage and says, "David, read this. People who are healthy in their minds don't think this way."
I'm sorry to interrupt, but were you taking it personally?
I guess to some extent I felt I had to explain my brother because he was so different and I thought I understood him better than...
So did the anger hurt you? The anger that he was displaying, did that hurt you? And then she was using the fact that he was ill as an explanation of saying, you have to understand this, that he is ill and it's not about you.
Yes. In fact, I remember I'd gotten one very, very angry letter from Ted and I thought, I was so angry. I thought, how could he do this? He's sort of written these letters to our parents. Now he's writing them to me. He doesn't like Linda, even though he's never met her. And I am kind of taking it personally. And Linda's saying to me, "David, this is your brother. This is an important relationship. You just can't be angry back to him. And besides, he's ill." And at that point, she actually persuaded me to take some of these letters to a psychiatrist. And that was the beginning of my process of education about my brother's problems. The psychiatrist reviewed the letters and said, look, David, I can't make a diagnosis based on letters. That's not how we do a diagnosis, but I'm pretty sure your brother is seriously ill, probably with schizophrenia, based on, you know, the ideology of these letters.
David Kaczynski is our guest this morning. His new book is Every Last Tie, The Story of the Unabomber and His Family. At what point in that discussion with the psychologist is it to understand your brother better, and how much of it is to, and we talk about this a lot when we talk about those who deal with family members who have an addiction, that there is our responsibility, but then there is also the guidance and the help that we need personally to get through that situation. So were you undergoing that as well?
I think the major motivation we had at this point was to try to find help for Ted. Is there some way we can get him into treatment? Here's the psychiatrist saying, you know, he's pretty ill. He'll probably get worse without treatment. And we're saying, how can we get him into treatment?
And the time frame on this is?
This is 19, oh gosh, I guess it would be about 1990, 1991.
Okay. Yeah. And the help is certainly understandable. And I guess the larger question I have, as you say, is you've become a bit of an advocate for mental health issues. Did the mental health system, such as it is in our country, fail your brother?
I think it's fair to say that the system could be vastly improved. And the question, I mean, there's some things that are no-brainers. I mean, we should make mental health treatment more available. We should make it more accessible. We should make it more affordable. In many parts of our country, it's very, very hard to get mental health treatment unless, you know, you're wealthy or have really good insurance. So that's a serious problem that we need to address. The kind of catch-22 that we're facing is what happens when you have a family member who's ill who doesn't know that they're ill. And I understand that approximately 50% of people who have a diagnosis of schizophrenia don't have insight into their illness. They
Right.
don't know that they're sick.
Yes.
So if a person like my brother thinks he sees more clearly than anyone, and it is in fact delusional, how do you get that person to accept treatment? Now, there was a wrinkle in all of this. You know, we actually went through this thought process with the psychiatrist. He began to, you know, strategize with us. What can we do? We knew that Ted had seen a doctor in Montana about a physical health issue. So we actually contacted that doctor, tried to talk with her. I shared some of the suggestions that the psychiatrist had made. She was her specialty was the heart.
Yes.
The physical heart.
Yes.
Not the mind. I don't think she really got it. Whether she spoke to Ted or not about the need to get some help for his problems, I really don't know. She ended up kind of disconnecting. And, of course, there is HIPAA laws. I mean, she
Sure.
owed confidentiality to her patient, not to her patient's family. So that was a bit of a quandary. Ultimately, I thought we were clutching at straws. You know, Ted was so unreachable. He was so far away. We did everything in our power to try to get him treatment. I once asked the doctor, should we pursue involuntary commitment in this case? And he pointed out that the law just really wouldn't allow that. If Ted were violent or if he were threatening suicide, in actuality, he was violent, but we had no evidence or knowledge of his violence. We might have been able to, get him committed. We would have been able to get him committed. The most I had to go on was that I thought my brother might be suicidal, but I didn't have any evidence of that. And the doctor said, basically, you know, you're between a rock and a hard place. Your brother's going to get worse without treatment, but you really have no recourse, no way to get him into treatment. And it's probably better to try to preserve a relationship with him rather than push him away by, you know, trying to have him involuntarily committed. I learned later, and this is something I mentioned in the book, is that Ted had actually independently, a few years before, written to the mental health clinic in Helena, Montana, about 60 miles away from where he lived, and he asked if he could do therapy through the mail.
Mm.
Now, I know Ted did not realize he was schizophrenic, but he knew he couldn't sleep. He knew he had high anxiety. And of course,
because of the ebbs and flows of the illness, there was a moment where he saw that clarity.
He knew he needed some sort of help.
Yes.
And he tried to get it. Now, for Ted, being as isolated as he was, as paranoid as he was, to go into a clinic, to pay for services that, without having money, maybe having to apply for welfare benefits, all of this would have been, they were insurmountable barriers from Ted's point of view. So there was this moment of opportunity where if the system had been a little bit more creative, maybe Ted could have gotten some help and maybe some lives would have been saved.
David Kaczynski is our guest. The book, Every Last Tie, The Story of the Unabomber and His Family. Is geography in this story both a blessing and a curse? In that you could have gone to Montana, you could have uprooted your life, you could have tried to could have gone right in there and said, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to take care of this problem. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to give up the life that I have with my own family.
Mm. Yes, and of course I was dealing with a family member who would not have welcomed me at that point.
Sure.
Ted was writing angry letters and basically saying, I don't want anything to do with you or anyone in our family again. It's interesting. Linda had been pushing me a little bit more to do what you suggest, maybe to go out there back at that time in the early 1990s and see if I could help my brother. And to me, it just seemed like he was unwilling. There was...
Which is the advice you were getting from doctors as well, is to stay, give him his space, and work on maintaining the relationship as opposed to trying to confront him.
Exactly.
The decision, once you find out, or once you believe, you strongly believe that your brother is the Unabomber and is responsible for mailing these bombs that killed and injured human lives. I can't even imagine. You write about it beautifully in the book, and I can't even imagine how agonizing that is. But when you come to that, are you working on family dynamics as well? Not just with your brother, but with all members of your family, because this really has to be a group decision, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think part of my motivation in writing the book is to let people know about Linda's role and her very, very important role in all of this. As a more objective person, she was the first person to suspect my brother. I think I could have buried it. Even after reading the manifesto, I remember I said, maybe there's a slight chance it's Ted. So I'm in this process of denial. She's trying to work with me to get me to see that it may be a more serious possibility than I'm willing to accept. And so... we're struggling with this question. First of all, is your brother the Unabomber? I remember telling Linda at one point, after we'd been reading the manifesto, comparing it to some of Ted's letters, that I thought there was a 50-50 chance that Ted had written the manifesto. And so at this point, we're struggling with two questions. Is he the Unabomber? But now... the more important, crucial question, what does this demand of us?
Right.
We may know the identity of someone who is out there killing people. If we do nothing, here's the dilemma we faced. If we do nothing, we might wake up someday and realize some other innocent person had been killed. If Ted was responsible, Linda and I would have to go through the rest of our lives with the blood of innocent people on our hands. I mean, that would have been unthinkable. On the other hand, if I turn in my brother, he's the most wanted person in America. He's killed three people. It's very likely he's going to get the death penalty. So I had to ask myself, what would it be like to go through life with my brother's blood on my hands. That was a very, very, very tough situation. But I think at that point, we had a question, should we invite our mother into this discussion? And I thought about that a lot. On one hand, maybe she had a right to know. She yeah. was a stakeholder. Maybe she might have some insight. On the other hand, if I had trouble being objective about Ted, you know, you could multiply that about 10 times for Mom. And also, we really didn't know. I didn't want Mom to, you know, maybe lose sleep or perhaps even, you know, have a heart attack or a stroke if it turned out Ted was completely innocent. But there was definitely the dynamic of a husband and wife. You know, a lot of attention has been given to me, my heroic decision. I think there was a shared process here. And I really think if we think about conscience, we find that it's very often not just invested in an individual, though obviously we each have a conscience, but it's invested in relationship. It's in the context of relationship. We decide what's right, what's wrong as people in relationship, as husbands and wives, as family members.
Right.
You can expand that and say, well, as a community, as a nation, you know, there is a kind of process that's shared where we try to figure out, you know, how do we deal with this problematic situation.
When did your mother come to understand?
Yes. Linda and I had actually gotten to the point of thinking we needed some kind of outside help. Linda had a childhood friend who was actually working as a private detective, so we brought her into this. She was able to find someone, actually a retired FBI agent, who was very skilled in language analysis. And we asked him to compare the manifesto to a number of letters that my brother had sent me over the years. And he came back with an estimate that the likelihood that the manifesto, that the author of the manifesto in those letters was the same person, he estimated to be about 60%. And so at that point, even though we had no clear, hard evidence, we realized we weren't just projecting, we weren't just imagining, we weren't worrying. There was a real chance my brother could be responsible. And at that point, there was one thing we could do, and that was if Ted was the Unabomber, we could stop the violence, and we felt we needed to do that. Mom came into this after we'd actually gone to the FBI. Linda and I had been in interviews, in regular communication with agents from the Unabom Task Force for a period of months. I guess about 6 weeks, actually, and it got to a point where one of the agents said, David, we really need to speak with your mother. Do you think you could go to her, explain what's going on, and persuade her to meet with us? So at that point, I had to approach Mom. I had to tell her not only what we feared, what we suspected, but also what we had done. And I really didn't know at that point whether I was going to lose my relationship, my love of my mother. I mean, can you imagine being right. in Mom's situation? You got one son who may be a very violent criminal and another son who's turned him into the police. Where does your heart go? Where does your loyalty lie?
Did she feel betrayed?
You know, at first, I came to her apartment. She lived in Scotia, New York at that point. I kind of sat her down. I asked her if she'd heard of the Unabomber, and she could see I was kind of upset, and I began explaining that, you know, some of the bombs had been placed or sent from places that Ted had lived previously. I also reminded her that Ted had this phobia, this obsession with technology, and that the Unabomber's manifesto was a critique of technology. And Mom's looking at me like I've lost my mind. I mean, she's looking with this look of horror on her face. I don't know if she thinks she's horrified at what I'm saying or horrified at the possibility that Ted could be the Unabomber. I said, Mom, I'm really worried that Ted might be the person responsible for these bombings. And Mom's first reaction was, David, don't tell anybody. She just kind of blurted it out. I think it was a mother's instinct.
Sure.
It wasn't who she was, really. And at that point, I had to say, Mom, I actually have told somebody. I've gone to the FBI. They're now investigating Ted to see if he might be involved. And Mom sat there in her chair for maybe 10 seconds. It must have felt like an hour to me. And then she just got up out of her chair, walked up to me, put her arms up around my neck. And she was a very short woman, mm-hmm. under 5 feet tall. I'm a little over 6 feet tall. But she reached up and put a kiss on my cheek. And the first thing she said was, David, I can't imagine what you've been struggling with. Mm. And the second thing she said was something I really needed to hear. She said, David, I know that you love Ted. I know that you wouldn't have done this except that you felt that you had to. It had been the worst moment of Mom's life, I think, and yet at this moment she sees the need to comfort her child. And at that moment, I half the weight of the world came off my shoulders.
I was going to say, maybe the worst moment for her life and perhaps one of the best in yours, that you have this approval from your mother to go ahead on one of the most agonizing decisions you've ever had to make.
And at this point, I knew that Mom, Linda, and I we'd face this ordeal as a family together.
I want to talk more about the story. David Kaczynski is our guest. The name of the book is Every Last Tie, The Story of the Unabomber and His Family. We will continue our discussion with David Kaczynski, who will be at the Open Door Bookstore in Gift Gallery in Schenectady from noon to 1:30 today for a discussion and a book signing. You can find out more by going to opendoor-bookstore.com for more information. We'll continue our chat with David Kaczynski after this short break. David Kaczynski is our guest this morning for this hour. David is the brother of the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. He is from Schenectady, New York, served as assistant director at Equinox in Albany, and also served as executive director of New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty, and more recently as director of a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Woodstock. He's written a new book. It is entitled Every Last Tie, The Story of the Unabomber and His Family. He will be at the Open Door Bookstore and Gift Gallery in Schenectady from noon today, noon to 1:30, for a discussion and a book signing, opendoor-bookstore.com for more information. You were telling us just before the break about the family coming together and your realization that this would now be a family project. And I'm interested, and you write about it beautifully in the book, but I'm interested in how organic or immediate was the decision that, okay, we're going to work with the FBI, we're going to help in any way we possibly can, that the decision to work so solidly on against the death penalty came into that discussion?
Sure. Actually, before we contacted the FBI, we talked to an attorney. We knew we needed some help and some representation in approaching the FBI. And consider at this point, they were getting like something like 20,000 tips from the public every month. Somebody would approach them. And we didn't have any clear, hard evidence. And in fact, when our attorney contacted the FBI, it was a couple of weeks before they even got back to us. It wasn't until I found in my mother's keeping an early essay that Ted had written that was kind of strikingly similar to the manifesto in some sense, that the bells and whistles all went off and then it was all starting. But one of the things I'd asked the attorney is there any way we could get something like a plea bargain in advance?
Right.
They've been looking for this person, spend millions of dollars and over a 17-year period trying to end this crime, this series of crimes, and would they at least give me my brother's life in return? And basically, the legal opinion was the system doesn't work this way. It's sequential. The police could actually make you promises, but the justice system isn't bound by those promises. And so we really had to go forward understanding that our clear, immediate motivation was to stop the violence. But secondarily, we wanted the FBI to know who they were dealing with, not a terrorist in the normal sense, not a member of a terroristic group or a militia, but someone with a serious mental illness. So I wanted them to really understand that they were dealing with a person who had psychological problems. And I hoped that that might help convince the justice system ultimately to spare my brother's life. I began to see that the system has so many different dimensions, and some of them are political. The death penalty is certainly a punishment that's been politicized for a long time in the United States of America. And I felt like it was almost just a lucky accident that my brother's life was spared. I think if we hadn't come forward, if he was simply a mentally ill man who had committed these crimes, he probably would have gotten the death penalty and been executed. But there was a political dimension. Most of the newspapers, even like the New York Times, and were kind of editorializing, look, you don't want to punish a family for doing such a brave thing. You want to encourage a family. And so we kind of appreciated that support from the media, and ultimately Janet Reno kind of overruled the prosecutors, and basically Attorney General at the time said, you know, we're going to offer a plea bargain. And so Ted has been sentenced to life imprisonment without possibility of parole. There was actually shortly after that, I was contacted by a man in California. His name is Bill Babbitt. And his story was remarkably similar to mine. He had turned in his own brother. His brother, he'd read some newspaper articles about an elderly woman whose house had been broken into and was murdered. And he began to suspect his brother, and he turned his brother into the police. The police promised him that his brother would not be executed. Now, his brother had spent a significant amount of time in the mental institution. He had actually a piece of shrapnel in his brain from World War II. From the Vietnam War. So all kinds of reasons why Bill's brother Manny should not have gotten the death penalty. Seriously mentally ill, turned in by his own family, and by the time Bill was contacting me, his brother was on death row. The appeals had run out. And Linda and I went to join Bill and his wife out in California to try to advocate against this system. And, you know, look at these two cases. Who deserves the death penalty? A Harvard-educated guy who killed three people with premeditation, or this, you know, Vietnam War veteran with a brain injury and a history of psychiatric problems, both turned in by their own brothers. And to see how that played out, like the inequality in the system, you know, to see that the system worked fine for a family like mine and with the good lawyers that Ted had. And here's this other family where the man gets executed simply because he had a terrible lawyer and there wasn't the same kind of public attention given to the case, really made me understand that, you know, the death penalty is more than a moral issue, that the system is broken. And of course, since then, I've, you know, learned about how many innocent people have been sentenced to death and in some cases executed. It became a passion of mine. But the passion was really, what was amazing about the passion was the ability through this advocacy against the death penalty to connect with other families, including murder victim family members who opposed the death penalty, and to understand that really, this punishment of death really doesn't serve anybody's interests.
So tell me if I'm right or wrong here, because in reading the book, it seems as though, obviously your mission is to save your brother's wife, but it seems like there are these moral seeds that were deep within you that were against this, against the idea of killing in the first place, of the death penalty, that played a part in this conversation.
Yeah. I remember, back when I was a teenager, I just kind of had a visceral sense that there was something that sort of mistaken about the idea that if we punish killers by killing them, somehow that this is justice, or that this will send the right message. So I was always kind of viscerally opposed to the death penalty. It became a more personal thing when my brother was exposed to the death penalty. And in some sense, it's sort of, here Linda and I were in this situation where we had to make a moral decision. It was about the value of human life. And if anything could have prevented me from turning in my brother, it was the prospect that he would be executed and put to death. And for me, that opened up into a much wider sort of meditation on, you know, how do we respond in the aftermath of violence? How do we respond to the horrible things that people sometimes do to one another? And I think what we need to discover in ourselves is a deeper sense of compassion. In other words, as Sister Helen Prejean once said, deeds of inhumanity challenge us to find our own deeper humanity. And I think it's that search for my own deeper humanity that that Linda brought out in me to begin with, and that I kind of felt I was pursuing in my work against the death penalty.
David Kaczynski is our guest. The name of the book is Every Last Tie, the story of the Unabomber and his family. He is going to be at Open Door Bookstore and Gift Gallery in Schenectady at noon today, noon to 1:30 for discussion and book signing. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and wrap up with David Kaczynski. We'll be back right after this short break. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning with David Kaczynski, brother of the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, who has written the book Every Last Tie. And David Kaczynski will be at the Open Door Bookstore and Gift Gallery in Schenectady from noon to 1:30 today. How spiritual, how religious was your family growing up?
It's interesting. My parents were both raised Catholic, and sometime in early adulthood, they gave it all up.
Split.
Ted and I were raised as agnostics, atheists, really. That's not to say that we didn't have a very strong training in morality. Mm-hmm. Morality was very important. If they brought us to anything like a church, it was called the Ethical Culture Society in Chicago, and the idea was we were supposed to be good people, but it didn't require a belief in God to be moral.
Did that play? The reason I ask the question is because after the death of your mother, you start to meditate and you go into, I mean, you end up running a Buddhist monastery. So there's a spirituality that comes, and I'm curious as to does that get you through the situation, or does it help you deal with the aftermath?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would think both. Certainly it's been very, very helpful in the aftermath. You know, I think the tenets of all of the major religions, including Buddhism, have to do with love and compassion. Yeah. And it strikes me that only through love and compassion can you, only by reaching out, opening your heart to other people, can you heal the wounds in your own heart. They're not going to heal by themselves. You have to you have to see a much larger world than yourself and your own ego. And I think all of the major religions really encourage us to practice love and compassion. And I think it's the most healing practice that I've experienced.
So bring us to the time where you're with your mother and you go to visit, you have a meeting with the victims, with the families. The victims of the families, the families of the victims, excuse me. What do you hope to accomplish in a meeting like that? And at what point do you fully understand? I mean, is it evolutionary even when you're having the meeting as to what is happening?
Mm-hmm. For sure. We'd actually... at the conclusion of Ted's trial, actually the day after Ted's trial ended, with the plea bargain that spared his life, we got a call from a chaplain that worked with law enforcement in Sacramento where the trial took place. And the chaplain told us that there was a victim family that really wanted to meet with mom and myself. And we agreed. We weren't sure exactly why they wanted to see us. It's kind of like in the courtroom, you're sort of separated. Even the lawyers tell you, you know, don't interact with the victims and et cetera.
Don't look in that direction.
It could be misinterpreted, you know, best just to keep your head down. And so, you know, there's a part of you, or at least me, that was thinking, what are they feeling? What are they thinking about all of this? So I guess I came with some openness, some curiosity, but a little trepidation too. I mean, our family member had killed their loved one. What's this going to be like to sit down with these people? What are they going to say? Are they going to feel hostility toward us as Ted's family member? Anyway, the chaplain led Mom and I into the room, and as we came into the room, we saw that there were five chairs arranged in a circle. In three of the chairs, there was the widow of somebody that my brother had killed with a bomb. There was her sister and her late husband's sister. The other two chairs were waiting for Mom and myself. And as we walk in the room, there's really only one thing we could be saying, which is, we're sorry, we're sorry. But I have to say, even to us, the words sounded kind of hollow. I mean, they were just words. They couldn't undo the damage that Ted had done. And I see Mom's crying a little bit, and we kind of sit down. And part of me was almost afraid that, you know, there would be a lot of anger here. And yet the widow spoke, and she said that their reason for inviting us to the meeting was to thank us. And I was just overwhelmed by that. She said she couldn't imagine how difficult it would be to turn in a family member in a case like this. And I'm thinking, I can't imagine how difficult it would be to lose a family member in a tragedy like this, as she had lost her husband. And so we actually, there was this immediate sense of, okay, we're on different sides in a certain sense in the courtroom, but in terms as human beings, we suffer. Our suffering is in some ways similar, and we can empathize. And I remember at one point hugging the victim's sister. Mom, I think, had an agenda of her own. She really, more than being thanked, it was important for her to help this family understand that her son was very, very sick, that Ted was not a monster, not an evil person, but a very, very sick man. And so she began speaking about schizophrenia.
Did they understand that?
Well, as soon as Ted's name came up, there was like a change in the room. You know, like we were human beings together, but Ted is, and as Mom is beginning to talk about schizophrenia and try to explain, she's trying to tell them one thing, and what they're hearing, I think, is somebody making excuses for the man who murdered their loved one. And at one point, the widow kind of blurted out, she just had to say something. She said, he knew what he was doing. And at that moment, the room was like frozen in silence. Like, it's okay, we can't, you know, argue about Ted's illness. Maybe this is more than we can ask of people, you know, human beings are capable of. And Mom just kind of looked down at the floor, and a small woman, she kind of rolled up into a little ball, and then she said, I really wish he had killed me instead of your husband.
Oh, my God.
And that's true. I mean, Mom, if she could have erased this, all of Ted's terrible deeds through laying down her own life, she surely would have done so. But I happened to be glancing at the widow's face when Mom said that, and I saw a change. You know, her eyes kind of welled up with tears. She's a mother, too. On this level, she can kind of relate, and she kind of eases herself out of her chair, kneels right down in front of Mom, looks up into Mom's face and says, oh, Mrs. Kaczynski, we don't blame you. Don't ever think that, you know, we blame you. You don't deserve this burden. And that moment for me was a truly, I mean, I thought I was seeing love and compassion in the flesh. It's not, you know, they're easy words to roll off your lips, but here were two women in great stress, great anguish, but they were able to feel empathy for each other. And to see the widow who had lost so much show compassion for Mom and try to comfort her left me realizing that human beings are pretty, pretty special. We have capabilities of love and compassion that transcend what we ordinarily think is possible.
The empathy that you write about in the book amongst your family, in the situation you just mentioned, is really powerful, of that capacity we have for empathy, something we have in our utility belt that maybe we don't use as often as we should.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because, you know, you look at today's politics, our culture, it's so adversarial.
Right.
You know, it's like something goes wrong and we're looking for someone to blame. And
get
it's 'em. Like we have so much more in common than we have differences. Right. As human beings, you know, we all bleed the same. We cry, we grieve. And it seems almost tragic that we've kind of got derailed into this, you know, our legal system is adversarial. Our politics is adversarial. Even our sports entertainment is adversarial. It's like, wait a second, you know, we're human beings. What about trying to love each other?
We just have less than a minute, but when was the last time you saw your brother?
Was in the courtroom, and at his trial in 1996.
Are you able to, would you be able to see him?
I would be able to see him. He would have to put me on a list of visitors. He won't. He's told his attorneys that he doesn't want to have anything to do with his family. And so that's painful.
You would go in a second.
I would go in a second. And I want him to know. I still continue to write him so that he will know the door is open, the heart is open, should he ever want to see me again.
But the illness still remains, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the prevention. And when we talk about a quote-unquote correctional facility, the one thing they're not dealing with is that mental illness.
Well, and it's tragic that, you know, our correctional institutions have become our modern-day mental institutions. About 20% of our state prison inmates have, you know, serious mental illness, and they're getting some treatment, but this is not what society should be doing for those who are most vulnerable.
David Kaczynski will be at the Open Door Bookstore and Gift Gallery in just about an hour, from noon to 1:30 today for discussion and book signing. The name of the new book is Every Last Tie, the story of the Unabomber and his family. It is such a powerful book and so filled with humanity and empathy and beauty. And I thank you so much for sharing it in the book form, but also sharing it on this program this morning.
Thank you, Joe.
A love to both you and your wife. Thank you very much. Again, David Kaczynski will be at Open Door Bookstore and Gift Gallery in Schenectady from noon to 1:30. Opendoor-bookstore.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.